From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
Hello from South Berkeley, below Ashby.
I live in North Richmond.
Kentfield.
Oh, I live in San Jose, near Campbell.
Bayview.
Coming up, a tech workshop in San Francisco takes on homelessness.
Frankly, a lot of hackers, ideologically committed hackers, don't have anywhere else to live.
Then we'll talk with a local writer about why San Francisco is the city of the future and what's holding us back.
Cities with an enormous income disparity are unstable. That looms over San Francisco as a question. How will we deal with the class divide?
Also, we'll visit the site of a dying institution, the local video store.
We're a neighborhood store, and all the customers are our neighbors. I'm surprised I'm even paid, as a matter of fact.
Life in the city, that's all coming up today on Cross Currents. The current tech boom in San Francisco has divided the city in some ways, pitting those people who are benefiting from it against those who feel pushed out by it. But local resident Danny O'Brien says it's more complicated than an us versus them dynamic.
One of the most shocking things I think about San Francisco and Silicon Valley for someone coming here from somewhere else is discovering that all of these, like a huge chunk of the technologists that you kind of imagine cause this problem, actually a lot of them don't have homes.
O'Brien is a member of a hackerspace called NoiseBridge. It's a place that fosters creative problem solving, mostly through computer programming. But NoiseBridge goes further. The space is run by an anarchist leading group of core members who see hacking as a path towards social justice. So it created a bit of a dilemma for the group when people started sleeping there. That's because NoiseBridge is not a shelter and sleeping is forbidden by the lease. That's led the founders to ask a difficult question. How do you hack San Francisco's homelessness problem? KALW's Holly J. McDeed brings us that story.
The NoiseBridge hackerspace, located on Mission and 18th Street, looks like a garage workshop scaled up to 5,200 square feet. There's sewing kits, a laser printer, a dark room, a kitchen, and a wood shop. And off in the corner, by the 3D printers and electroencephalogram, there's Chris Zapata's sort of bed.
There's a hacker stacker with three spots, and the hacker stacker is like three just basic pods with a yoga mat and stairs for the top two levels.
It's 1 a.m. or so on a Monday morning, and Zapata is showing me around.
Can I say the disclaimer where I don't feel like I represent the space?
Yeah.
Okay. Disclaimer. I am not a member of, or have ever been a member of, the hackerspace known as NoiseBridge.
This is a crucial distinction. Members make the rules at NoiseBridge. They pay dues to cover the building's rent, and they decide who can use the space.
Rule number one is, be excellent. Rule number two, is, if you don't know anything, ask someone. And rule number three is, I don't know rule number three, actually. I think those are just two rules.
Zapata's still learning how NoiseBridge works. He's attracted to the hacker ethos of duocracy, that action of any kind is valued and rewarded. But he's got more pressing reasons to stay at NoiseBridge. He's homeless, and the mission is dangerous at night.
In my sense, in my case, it's partially a choice, I guess, to squat here or to leave to nap here sometimes.
Since NoiseBridge moved to this location in 2008, there's been constant debate about people like Zapata, whether they're hackers or just crashers.
And so what we say to people is, yeah, you know, you come here to hack, but like, what does hack mean?
Danny O'Brien is one of 100 or so members of the collective. About 900 other people also use the space each month. O'Brien says those people do a lot of things that technically qualify as hacking.
You know, trying to break into computers recreationally, but it also means like doing stuff in the wood shop, and it also means like playing pranks on people. And you can always kind of defend yourself by going, no, I'm just hacking this sandwich, or, you know, I'm hacking my sleep patterns or something.
It's a safe place. It's a good place. I like it.
Mark O'Neill was sleeping at NoiseBridge until about a month ago, when he was banned. The charge was lack of hacking, Or, more specifically, repeated drunken behavior, including spreading cheesecake over his face and taking his pants off in what he called an art experiment. Yet O'Neill insists that he's contributed.
I'm always working. I don't need much sleep.
A bit scattered, sorry. I've been up for a while working in the new machine shop.
What class do you teach?
How to make anything. Industrial design. How to make anything out of anything.
O'Neill disagrees with the ban, but he doesn't get a say. Only members are allowed to block votes. And member Paul Manon says banning people is the only way to maintain an inclusive environment.
A lot of the regular people won't come here. A lot of women, a lot of kids won't come here because they perceive they do not have access to a safe environment.
Manon says someone like O'Neill is a nuisance, but they've had to confront more serious problems, things like thievery, assaults, drug abuse, and property damage. So they try to enforce the rules consistently, and that sometimes means kicking people out.
For instance, this morning, I happened to come to Noisebridge at 5 a.m. Just to drop off something, and I found 8 people sleeping here. Maybe 3 of them were actually, you know, some of the usual hackers around here. The rest of them look like street people that just kind of dropped in.
Danny O'Brien acknowledges that the line between napping and sleeping can be blurry, and that it can stand in for that bigger question of who's a hacker at all.
So with 1,000 people, it's really possible to walk in and not know anyone else. And so I think that what that means is if somebody is, like, you know, laid out on the sofa, like, do you go and wake them up and go, no, you must be hacking? It's awkward.
I'm trying to do basically, like, I have 3 LEDs, and I want to have one control line that controls all of them, so, like, 1 volt and 1 or 2 volts.
During the day, Noisebridge is a nerd haven. You can't walk in without someone asking you what you hack. There's circuit hacking classes, Python classes, a Dream Team brain hacking class, and a 3D game development group. That's just on an average day. At night, people still work intently. Every sound seems to echo, as though Noisebridge were a cave. The night I met Chris Zapata, I tried sleeping at Noisebridge. Over in the kitchen, one hacker was making a smoothie, nodding distractedly as Mark O'Neill blissfully reported his day's adventures. Zapata searched through the refrigerator and grabbed some cherries. I didn't see a Noisebridge member anywhere, and every soft surface was occupied. Around 5 a.m., I scored a hacker stacker. There was a dog above me that wouldn't stop growling. The man sleeping above him was snoring. And by that time, Mark O'Neill was drunk and loud. There was no way I was getting to sleep.
Live! Live!
Danny O'Brien says most members don't think Noisebridge should have to deal with these kinds of problems, and adds that they already offer a lot to help the homeless. Anyone can subscribe to the Noisebridge jobs page. You can take a class on programming. You can use a computer. And the Noisebridge wiki page offers links to sources of food, shelter, storage, and showers.
If anyone can come up with, like, a solution for homelessness that involves writing some programs in C or an iPod app, then by all means email us and let us know, because we'd be right on it.
Chris Zapata knows his days at Noisebridge might be numbered.
If it comes down to that, then I wouldn't mind presenting myself to the community, because I feel that, at least the way I used it and the way I've napped here, is I've tried to be the least offensive, you could say, least offensive napping, and I don't think I snore, or I try not to smell so much.
Zapata slept in shelters before, but he was only able to get a bed twice. The other times, he had to sleep on a chair, clinging tightly to his belongings. Plus, at shelters, he's always had to be out by 5 a.m., so he says he's grateful for Noisebridge, and he tries to respect the rules.
Even if you can't exactly utilize the space as it was meant to be, that there's always still that possibility, like, it'll rub off on you eventually. And the people and the skills and the minds and the openness will rub off on you, and you will learn something to work with your hands and to work with your mind.
The hackers of NoiseBridge may know how to build robots, print whistles from 3D printers, and read brainwaves. But homelessness remains a problem they haven't solved. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
How would you hack San Francisco's homelessness problem? Or do you know someone who's doing it right? You can let us know at our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message and we'll try and tell your story. 415-264-7106. Listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. The problems San Francisco's facing today could potentially change the course of the city's future. And local author Annalee Newitt says that future is something we should start trying to protect right now. Newitt wrote the new book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. She describes it as an optimistic book about extinction. In it, she looks at how humans could deal with a catastrophe along the lines of what killed the dinosaurs. Newitt says one thing we need is strong, resilient cities, and that San Francisco is a model for the world. Newitt spoke with KALW's Casey Miner about adaptation, innovation, and what we can learn from the time local developers almost turned the bay into landfill.
This was a real plan. This was what the city was going to do. They were going to fill the bay with landfill and cover it with houses because, just like now, there was a housing crunch. We needed room. They had already successfully used landfill to build out the marina, so we knew it could be done. And so why not? And conservation groups managed to organize partly by partnering with industrialists. And today you might compare that to, say, partnering with Google or some other very wealthy company in the area. So they partnered with industrialists, they lobbied politicians, they helped create grassroots organizations in the city to protest doing this. And as a result, we kept our bay. And that bay is now an incredible treasure trove of information for scientists about how to prevent climate change. It's interesting that not only is it, of course, a lovely example of building ecology and environmental concerns into a city, but also what we found in the last 10 years is that a lot of the bacteria living in the wetlands around the bay actually are incredibly great carbon sinks. And that's, of course, what we want to do. We want to get carbon out of the atmosphere and back down into the earth. And so there's a lot of scientists at Berkeley now who are studying this thankfully preserved area, looking for clues about, hey, could we use what we're learning from these bacteria to actually help draw carbon down out of the environment? So it's kind of had this long-term beneficial effect for both the people in the city and scientists. And I think that idea of combining city development with environmental concerns is very futuristic. Maybe we haven't done perfectly here in San Francisco, but we're certainly on the right path. And if you want to look at what's caused mass extinctions in the past and what may be causing one, you know, coming down the pike in the future, it's pretty much always been climate change. And here in the Bay Area, we have an incredibly thriving group of people innovating around green technologies and trying to think about how do we have more efficient solar cells? How can we create generators for solar fuel? How can we create better high-performance windows? How can we build our cities to behave more like a living organism and not have a carbon footprint that is any different from the actual environment around us? So I think that's another thing that makes the city particularly ripe for surviving into the future, as long as we don't sink into the water or have a catastrophic earthquake from which we can't recover.
We're speaking with Annalee Newitz. She's the author of the new book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. And you're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Casey Miner. So, you know, we were talking about San Francisco as a hub for innovation and all these ideas. And it's also a place that a lot of people are having to leave for basically exactly that reason. And in the book, one of the things you mention is actually that historically cities tend to collapse when people don't have a certain amount of economic mobility and they have to go elsewhere. And so it was interesting for me to think of San Francisco as a blueprint for the future, because on the one hand, it has all these characteristics that set it up really well for that future. But on the other hand, there is a certain amount of stagnation happening right now.
I'll say a few things to that. First of all, it is true that cities with an enormous income disparity are unstable. That looms over San Francisco as a question. How will we deal with the class divide? As we're looking toward the future, we need to be thinking about what kinds of basic services we think should belong to everyone. And right now, we're all pretty happy with the idea that, like, well, no matter how poor you are, you shouldn't be deprived of heat and water and, you know, hopefully food. But although people seem a little confused about whether the poor actually need food, which is a little puzzling to me. But I think going forward, we need to start thinking about the fact that everyone should have a right to their own energy source. So as we start thinking more about solar or biofuel, thinking about people being able to do that, be living off the grid, essentially. We also need to start thinking about access to the information infrastructure. I was talking a lot before about how San Francisco is so great because we have all this science and technology that's being developed here. And then we also have neighborhoods where people have horrifically bad internet access or no internet access at all. And I think San Francisco really needs to be thinking about the idea that having access to that information should be a right for everyone. I think any sane plan for the future of our city has to take into account that we need to be making room, both technologically, but also just in terms of physical room, for people from many different backgrounds, income backgrounds, but also for immigrants and, you know, people who have historically been kind of booted out of the city.
Say you were going to take San Francisco and you got to do whatever you wanted with San Francisco to make it a resilient city for the future, what would you change and why?
That is a really good question. If I were in charge of San Francisco, you know, there's a couple things that I would do. One is that I think we really need a systematic way of thinking about how we're going to develop moving forward. I think one of the really kind of bright lights in San Francisco's future, if it happens, is this idea of creating a transit hub downtown where we limit the number of cars that are available, but at the same time, beef up our public transportation enough that we make up for the loss of those cars. And if that can really work, I think that is exactly what I would hope for the future of the city. And I'd like to see more of that being done. And part of the thing that's really hopeful to me about that transit plan isn't just the idea of getting more public transit, which is, of course, crucial, but the fact that it also includes high-density housing. And I think in San Francisco, we have always been kind of weirded out by high density housing. You know, we like our pretty city. We like the idea of things being kind of no more than three stories high, except really right downtown in the financial district. And that has to change, because the most sustainable way of living is to put a lot of people in one place where you can scale up the need for resources like electricity or water in a way that's much more cost effective. And it allows you to use a much smaller number of resources to get people the energy that they need, for example. So really, San Francisco of the future is going to have some megastructures in it. And the good news is that megastructures actually deal really well with earthquakes because you can build them to sway, which sounds terrifying, but is actually in terms of an engineering really great. It means that the building kind of bends with the movement of the earth. That's what you want to have happen. And so I hope that our city can grow taller. I would really like our city to be totally carbon neutral. Imagine in the future these huge tall buildings that are fueled by solar or fueled by biofuels, solar fuels, whatever we wind up using, and where people are able to live in close proximity, but also because we have such high density, they can also enjoy things like public parks and public transit that takes them to places where they're not crammed into a building, because I know not everybody thinks that's the most awesome idea. Hopefully that would look beautiful. I can imagine lots of ways that it could go wrong, but I can also imagine a lot of ways where you could have
just beautiful soaring buildings that are covered in solar panels and that that are covered in even gardens and plants. And I think that would be kind of where I'd want to see the city going.
Writer Anna Lee Newitz is the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. She spoke with KALW's Casey Miner. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. While humans may not be facing extinction yet, there is one business that has been dying a slow death, your local video store. With Netflix and other online viewing options growing ever more popular, it's become rare to see an old-fashioned video rental store. But the Video Room on Piedmont Avenue in Oakland has escaped the fate of many of its competitors. It's been going strong for 30 years now. KALW's Dora Finkelstein dropped in to see what's showing.
My name is Joseph Flum. I started the store in 1983.
My name is Bill Wiedemeyer. I'm the manager of the store, and I've been here for 15 years.
We started at College Point. We moved over to Piedmont Avenue 10 years later, and then we moved to this spot 5 years after that. So we've been here over 20 years. We first started out as a Laserdisc store.
Another bright idea from Magnavox.
And that was a failure, so we added VHS tape.
Another Panasonic experience just slightly ahead of our time.
And we moved over to DVDs and Blu-rays now.
With pristine 1080p pictures and superior high-definition surround sound.
One of the reasons for our success is that we've always been, tried to be, on the cutting edge of the industry.
When we started here in 1983, within a few months, Blockbuster opened about a half a mile from us, and we suffered greatly.
Well, that wasn't in 1983, Joe. No, I think that was in about 10 years after that. When they did come in, we did lose some customers to Blockbuster. And, of course, now those customers have lost Blockbuster, which is too bad, but some of them are coming back to us.
Okay, and even though you don't want me to ask you it, I'm going to ask you what your favorite movie is.
There's too many to choose from, but My Fair Lady.
Just you wait, Henry Higgins, just you wait. You'll be sorry, but your tears will be too light.
I'll give you three favorite movies. Dinner with Andre, which is a conversation between two gentlemen in a restaurant.
Tell me, why do we require a trip to Mount Everest in order to be able to perceive one moment of reality? I mean, is Mount Everest more real than New York? I mean, isn't New York real?
I think Matrix is my favorite sort of blockbuster, computer-generated movie in the last several years.
What is real? How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, what you can taste and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain.
And I'm a very big, large Terrence Malick fan, and so I would have to say, of his movies, I like The Thin Red Line the best.
What difference do you think you can make one single man in all this madness?
30 years is a long time, and there's probably no other video stores that have been in business this long, to be honest with you. And they are, as you know, becoming an anachronistic business. They are slowly, but inevitably, it seems, fading. But we intend to be the last one standing, and we're now, our motto is 30 plus, and next year it'll be 30 plus one, and then it'll be 30 plus two, and as long as we can stay open, we will. We're a neighborhood store, and all the customers are our neighbors. And we enjoy talking to them and servicing them, and there's really nothing hard about this job at all. I'm surprised I'm even paid, as a matter of fact.
Bill Wiedemeyer and Joseph Lum spoke with KALW's Dora Finkelstein at the Video Room in Oakland. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Jen Chien, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Teddy Lederer, Chris Hoff, Judy Silber, Stephen Short, Nina Gensler-Debs, Holly J. McDeed, and Daniel Moore. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to you, KALW is independent, listener-supported public radio. Thank you.
There's a small room deep inside my heart.
Songwriter Jim Bruno, who you're hearing now, says his biography sounds like the opening of a blues song. I was born in Chicago in the shadow of an iron forge. Jim Bruno will be playing his own compositions this Friday at the Bazaar Cafe on California Street in San Francisco. Music starts at 7 p.m. For more information or to hear more local music, visit our website. It's kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
California rain. There's a lighthouse.